Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality. So, hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we are going to be talking about pharmaceutical drugs and the opioid epidemic and the awfulness that is being addicted to prescription drugs. Rochelle, do you want to talk about why you wanted to bring this subject up?
Well, as I told you, there's a special on HBO Max called Crime of the Century, and it's a two-part series, and it talks specifically about the opioid crisis. And what's really interesting about that is the process to get a drug to market and then managing that drug. So, for example, for the opioids, and they talked about a family called the Slackers, and I guess their family had started out many, many years ago, Sacklers. It's not Slackers, Sacklers. I've changed my word around, but
there's a Freudian slip there with
exactly. But they started out very early on. They were the original Sacklers came to the United States as immigrants, and they became doctors. They worked in a lot of mental hospitals and stuff like that. Eventually, they bought and started their own company, and so a lot of this program does that talks about the Sacklers and their push to get opioids into the marketplace and renaming its use. So if you take any kind of medicine, it has a best use case, so whether it's indicated or contraindicated for X things. So for example, if you take aspirin, it's not indicated for curing liver disease or diabetes, it's indicated for headaches and pain control and various things like that, keeping your blood thin and stuff like that. So what they did with the opioids very early on is opioids, when they were first introduced and they first used, they were so for cancer patients at the end of life or anyone that was in the end of life to mediate pain. Yeah. And then, as you look at the history of it, they started to see how much money they can make for it. They worked through the DEA, the FDA, and all these other people to get it changed to be used for pain management for anyone, not at the end of life. And they told a story that said this medicine was not addictive, right? So I think they had a statistic like 1 in 29 people may become addicted to it. Well, obviously we know now that's not the case, right? So we know that a lot of people take this drug and become addicted to it. And then you get all these pain clinics and doctors pushing pain medicine. And then all of a sudden you have an epidemic where people are dying left and right. Yeah. And of course, not being a doctor and not understanding the pharmaceutical process altogether, but it just seemed like to me that, some of the powers were taken away from the DEA to shut down these manufacturers, not necessarily shut down the pain clinics and all that stuff, but to shut down the manufacturers, to charge them penalties and to investigate how they're manufacturing a drug. And so when you think about the human costs of this, right? So, I have several health issues and, I have pain medicine, and most of the time I don't take it. And it's not that I don't take it because I don't want to take it. I don't take it because of the feelings that you have when you take it. So if you go to the dentist and you get a tooth pulled, especially a wisdom tooth, you're going to have some kind of major surgery. You may get morphine and then you may go home with some oxycodone or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the feelings that it gives you makes you loopy. It makes you feel strange. You feel almost like an out of body experience. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, who would want that feeling continuously? And so I was thinking about, what I read before about the crack epidemic. There were people who were saying that once you took the crack one time, the feeling was so great, you wanted to keep repeating that feeling. And I just wonder, is that the same thing with opioids and methamphetamines? You're constantly chasing that great high or whatever that thing is. And, when you think about these things and these drugs, you have to wonder about how we in a society allow those most vulnerable to be susceptible to things like this. And then they're caught on the other side of it. And to keep in the vein with what we do, technology, if you think about how technology is now able to do this, right? So if you go to the doctor you have a prescription for X number of things. There is a computer and some technology that dispenses the perfect amount into the pill bottle. And then it comes up with these rubrics. So, you know, look at, you know, what conditions you have. So if you have heart disease or you have cancer, you have whatever it is, it may look at whether the efficacy of this drug on those other drugs. So, you know, it just seems like to me that we as a society need to do better about understanding what we give to people. And I want to say one other thing before I stop talking. We are fighting so hard to prevent marijuana legalization, yet still we've got these other drugs that are legal that are way more powerful and more harmful than marijuana. Now, I don't know what marijuana does or does not do, but it seems like to me, I have not heard of anybody overdosing on marijuana. Now, that might have happened, but I don't think
it's technically possible, at least from what I've read.
Right. So, you know, and you think that we've legalized a drug that is killing hundreds of thousands of people, and we're fighting against legalizing a drug that, and I guess the pain side of marijuana, I hear a lot of people talk about pain, marijuana helping to mediate pain. And I've heard people talk about marijuana helping for people who are tense or have anxiety kinds of things. Yeah. But we legalize one drug and not the other.
Yeah, I agree that it's totally insane. And like, you know, marijuana is a plant that comes from the earth, and you know, all these opiates are like manufactured in labs, which is sort of it's a big contrast. I don't quite understand the fight of why the politicians are fighting against marijuana legalization either. And I guess in a lot of places they're losing, like Virginia, that's going to be legal like this summer or something, which seems crazy. And they're, you know, a state away. The thing that sort of scares me about the opioid addictions is like thinking about like having, you know, taking an opiate and having that like out of body experience, like, I don't think that I would really like that, but it doesn't scare me. Like the thing that scares me about the opioids is like the physical addiction that people get from it. And like, you know, if you have these opioids and then you don't continue to take them, or you don't like, you know, tone down on them, like it's just, people get obsessed with them. And like, that's all they can do is thinking about getting their next Oxycontin or whatever. There was a good NPR, I assume it was like This American Life, talking about a little town where doctors were just prescribing those opioids like left and right. It's like, oh, you got a back problem? Here's some opioids. Oh, you can't sleep? Take some opioids. And then people just can't get off of them. And, you know, now they're doing whatever they can to just like, you know, get a tiny bit of another opioid pill just to get them like through the day and feeling normal. And that's like terrifying.
Absolutely. And I think that the thing that's really interesting, and, you know, I did not know a lot about, you know, pharmaceuticals in that sense, you know, until I started doing a little bit of research. And, you know, so like you hear Oxycontin, mm-hmm. Oxycodone, what's the difference between those two words? And literally Oxycontin, the cotton just means oxycontinuous. They just chopped off the pieces of that. So if you go to the doctor and you get a typical prescription for oxycodone or something like that, you get one that's immediate. As soon as you take it, it goes to work in your body. Yeah. The oxycontin is time released. So it's continuous release of oxycodone in your body, right?
I didn't know that. I thought it was just different ways to pronounce the same thing.
Right. And a lot of people think that, right? But and the same thing is true for a lot of if you hear the word cotton on the end of a sentence, it just means it's a continuous, and not cotton. I'm probably cut, you know, the way you would say continuous, but oxycontin in the way that it is just a medicine that is released over time in your system. And so if you think about this, they did one of the stories they did on a woman. She had been in a train accident. I think she had been hit by a train and her back was broken or something. And so she had like oxycodone, she had morphine, she had like all of these fentanyl, she had all of these big drugs. And so she was taking her medication as they said on the bottle. And then she forget she took it. So if she took it at 10 o'clock, an hour later, she'd be taking it again. Eventually she died of an overdose from this medicine because she had taken so much. And her husband said, every time she would take the medicine, she'd become very loopy or she'd be confused, disoriented. And he said, this is a continuous cycle that he experienced with her. And he would go back to the doctor and say, hey, I don't think this is helping her. He said, well, she's not in pain anymore or something like that, but not understanding that this is more of a problem. Yeah. And specifically in young people. So young people seem to be drawn to these drugs in a greater rate than older people, because I think we get a little bit older. We are a little bit more cognizant of how these things can affect our body. But, you know, I'm sure you're young enough to remember when people are sniffing glue and paint fumes and all these things. So, you know, young people are always looking for a way to expand their mind, if you will, without recognizing it's expanding their health, meaning it's putting their health at risk with these drugs, you know. And so there was a few years ago, there was a lot of stuff on the news about, you know, locking up your medicine. So don't put them in the medicine cabinet, but put them, especially if you've got these high power drugs, you know, put them somewhere else. But I think that in a large part, marijuana and all these other drugs, like you can't go buy heroin on the street. You cannot. It's not like they got a ABC heroin store, right? So they have the ABC people who manage liquor in North Carolina. You can't go to a opium store like that. But yet and still, the key ingredients in fentanyl and opioids and morphine and all these things is the poppy and fentanyl is a derivative of that. So in a lot of ways, these drugs that are Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 by the IRS and the DEA and all those other definitions that they have for these things are drugs that are harmful. The problem is when you try to classify a whole society, and we can take prohibition, you know, back in the early 20th century. So they prohibited people from drinking alcohol, and people went black market to get this. And bootlegs, and you know, they still have people who make moonshine in their backyard. You know, so you got all of these this alcohol that came into the market, and people were able to get it without permission of the government. So then the government said, "Well, hell, if they're going to go about us, we will legalize it and we'll collect taxes on it," which makes perfectly good sense because they have some control over that. But now you take these other kinds of drugs, which, you know, marijuana is one, and I've heard a lot of people say marijuana is a gateway drug, and I don't know exactly what that means, but I'm assuming it just means it could lead to other drugs.
Yeah,
that might be true. I don't know that to be a fact, but the point is that you have a drug that is, from what I can read and I can determine, and I read a lot about this, marijuana is not addictive in the way that other drugs are. Now, I don't know. So if you look at Snoop Dogg and some of these other people, they always seem to be high. I don't know what that is, and I don't know all of the pieces and parts of that, but it doesn't look like it disrupts your ability to function.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing some of these harder drugs, you know, these poppy-based drugs, you know, you don't seem to be able to function. So why does the government and politicians seem to be so against it? You know, but I think if we can cross our fingers, they may be coming around to seeing the value of this so that you aren't putting people in jail for marijuana. You know, and I don't know what, I mean, I guess if you have a whole lot of marijuana, it must be some kind of crime. But one of the things I read is that as long as you don't have it in a distribution form, it's not, and you don't have a massive amount, it's not a felony. It might be a misdemeanor, but not that. So
yeah,
it's again, one of those things when you think about, you know, what are we doing? So how is marijuana different from alcohol? So what does alcohol do to your body and to your brain? What does marijuana do? What does methamphetamines, what does crack, all of these drugs do, you know? And I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems like to me that the categorization needs to be revisited so people can understand what the harms are and also put things in place to prevent young people and people who will abuse these drugs from getting access to them without having help or treatment.
Yeah. I totally agree. Like, I don't think any of them are necessarily like, healthy like for you, but at this, like, alcohol isn't healthy, and it's perfectly legal and socially acceptable to have, like, you know, more or less all the time. The thing that I think is interesting about the marijuana legalization, at least in Virginia, is that they are, like, along with the decriminalization, they're, like, going to, I believe they're going to expunge people's, like, arrest records for people that actually had it, which is I was sort of surprised to hear that, because I was like, oh, well, I mean, it makes perfect sense, but that's like going a long way towards totally, I guess, normalizing it. I remember I didn't really understand the opioid thing until I guess it was probably like in the height of the opioid thing. And like doctors were saying, like doctors would have signs on the door saying like, hey, we don't prescribe opioids at all. Like go somewhere else. Like you're never going to get those here. And I was like, oh, well that's weird. And then like you hear about more and more people just like dying from it. And not, you know, not like, I don't know what the right word is. It was just, I would call them like everyday people, you know, like teachers, nurses, all these people that have just, you know, become silently addicted to these pain medications. And like you were saying, you know, you don't know how, when you took your last one and then you take another one and another one, another one. And then like, you just don't wake up. And it's very, very scary. How do you see, so I know one comparison a lot of folks draw is that when the crack epidemic was real bad in the 80s, the government went hard on arresting people. And when the opioid pandemic started raging, you know, over the last decade, it became a, oh, these people need help. We need to help and get them in rehab. Like, do you think that society has progressed, or do you think that society was just much more racist in the 80s? And since the crack epidemic, a lot of it was focused on Black communities, do you think that the government just didn't care?
So interestingly enough, and no matter how many times you try to tell the story, majority of people who were addicted to crack were white. The
really?
Problem is the Black neighborhoods was on TV at night, right? So you could see all the shootings and stuff. And I think that from where I understand this, you know, so if you have a child that's addicted to drugs, you know, and they steal from you or they do something to you, you may find yourself, you know, maybe preventing your child from coming to your house or something like that. But it's not like you're going to allow your child to fall by the wayside. But when you look at the Black community, you know, first of all, you're starting off behind the eight ball, right? Because you are poor, you know, a lot of us are poor, and we don't have good structures behind us, you know, because, you know, if you look at the arrest thing, you know, if you know, think about incarceration, you know, Black people go to jail at a much higher rate than any other population followed by Brown people, you know, so we are first and second, and then there's everybody else. So when crack hit back in the 80s, you know, it was easy to point the spotlight on the Black people in the neighborhoods like Chicago and New York and all these other places. It was easy to point to that.
Yeah.
What you see in today's society is methamphetamines is a lot like that now. So, you know, they are arresting and cracking down on these meth houses and stuff like that. The problem is it's not exploited the way that crack was and put on television and media size the way that, you know, crack was. But I think that in a lot of ways it was like many things. I don't know if you remember this, you might be too young to remember this, but you know, a lot of times when you'd have crime in a neighborhood or you'd have something happen in a Black neighborhood, they'd find the person that looked like they were a train wreck, right? So whatever it is, they'd have rollers in their head, they'd have a baby on their hip, wouldn't have any teeth, you know, it'd be all kinds of something and other, because that was easy to point in, paint a narrative of what Black people look like. So this is, if you interview us, even in our moments of crisis, this is what we look like. You know, when you look at Mr. Floyd or any of these other things, these parents don't look like anymore because we stopped focusing the camera on the worst person we could find. And we started seeing just everybody, everyday people. Mm-hmm. I think that the difference is with, you know, there was, so first of all, you know, if you consider this just health insurance, so right. So how many Black people have continuous health insurance that they can go to get mental health treatment, right? So if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, do you see, is there a Part E that says mental health? Because, you know, there's medication, there is dental, there is prescriptions and things like that, but there is no mental health provision within the Medicaid system, the Medicare system. So for Black people who were on the crack epidemic and stuck on these addictive drugs, where were they going to go to get the mental health? Because the government didn't want them to use Medicare. It is, because even if you ask people to this day, people who have never worked and the only thing they've gotten is welfare. And again, it's another one of those stories, because the way they tell the story, Black people are the only people on welfare, and that's not true. The majority of people who get welfare are white, but the way they tell the story is Black people. And so when you think about that, if you don't have access to mental health insurance, you can't have a mental health issue. Because if you were to have, like, if let's just say if you were to become an alcoholic or a gambler, you wanted to be treated for that, the first thing they're going to ask you, who is your insurance company? You know, they're not going to ask you how you're doing, how long you've been. The first thing they ask you is, who is your insurance company?
Who's going to pay for this?
Right. And so if you're a crack addict, you know, likelihood you don't have insurance or you don't have good relationships with people who may have insurance. So you're going to be out there on the wrong side of this. So that couldn't have been a mental health crisis or something like that. But if you're white, argumentatively, there's an assumption that you have health insurance. You're a normal person, right? You pay your bills, you have health insurance, you dotted all the I's and crossed your T's. If you're Black, there's an assumption you have none of that. And so whatever problems you have, you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good. And that points out another like really good assumption that like, you know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, the crack epidemic, that was like, you know, Black and brown neighborhoods. That's just, I just, for some reason, like never questioned it. It's just, that's what I see on TV. That's what I see on media. Like, that's what I see on, you know, my TV shows and movies. It's just like, oh yeah, Drew, like, of course, of course.
And it's intentional. They do that intentional because that's what they're hoping you will assume that.
Yeah.
Because if you assume I'm a human being and that I am not a crack addict or that I am not the worst person in the world, you can't treat me this way. But if I can tell everybody this is who you are and this is what we did for a long time. There was something on the Nixon in the show. You remember Nixon was recording all of his conversations. Brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Part. Right there. He was recording all of his conversations and he talks about the Black people. He talks about Black people and Mexicans. And what he says is that Mexicans that live in Mexico are better than Mexicans that live in America. And because they're you know, lazy and all these other things. And then he says about Black people, we live like dogs. So we can't be recruited or changed because we are this thing. And so if you can plant that story over and over and over again, it becomes a part of the lexicon of how we see ourselves in our thing. This, you know, when you look at TV and they say Black people do crack, you don't question either one of those words, Black people and crack. You just say, well, they say Black people do it, crack, that goes together. So it becomes a narrative that we tell that Black crack is a Black epidemic when it is not. There has not been a single epidemic, whatever it is, where there is crime, drugs, murder, whatever it is, where Black people rule the day. The problem is we're just more likely to pay the highest price for it because we are such a small part of the society. We can't be all of that, right? So if you took everybody in the whole world, 13%, I believe we might be at 14% of Black people, and you every Black person you knew did crack, that still wouldn't make it up to the meter where we are, where it looks like it's a Black problem.
Yeah,
it's not possible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's that's a great point, and very, as always, very, very enlightening. Oh goodness. So what do you think about? So thinking about going back to opioids, like, do you think that there is any like legitimate use for that besides sort of the end of life care?
So my husband had his wisdom tooth pulled about 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was in a lot of pain and they sent him home with oxycodone or something. I don't know what the hell they said. One of those oxy things they sent him home with. Mm-hmm. And he took it and made him sick to his stomach. When my son had all the surgeries he had for his health issue, he had a subscription to it, you know, that he could get renewed. And I think in both cases it helped, but the mm-hmm. problem is the side effects are so devastating. You know, so I do think if you're in chronic pain, so I've had 2 or 3 rotator cuff surgeries. And so every 6 months or so, I go and get a steroid injection because mm-hmm. the pain is so debilitating. I mean, this is my right arm and I can barely use my right arm. So I can't pick up a pot. You know, I can't put my hand back or any of that stuff, you know. So yes, I think that there are very valid uses for it. The problem is like anything else. So I'll give you an example. Take your child when he was young in Halloween, right? Mm-hmm. So he'd go out and he'd get all this candy. You're going to sit there and let him eat every piece of candy he got during Halloween. You manage how much candy he got, right? So if he got a basket full of candy, you're not going to sit there and let him eat every piece of that candy. Medicine has to be that same way. Even though the doctor may not be with the patient every day, if you're giving a patient a high dose of an addicting medication, you need to then have some contact with that patient on a regular basis. You know, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Come into the office. You know, some prescriptions, like some of the medicines will say, you know, you have to come in if we can get a refill, something like that. So there's a checks and balances. So yes, I do think there's a validity for them. I just think it cannot be unsupervised.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I was listening to another story about, it sounds so like sketchy, but like people with medical degrees would just have like a fake doctor's office, more or less, like an office, and people would come in and say like, hey, I want some Oxycontin, And the doctors would just be like, okay, that'll be $500.
Right.
Write them a prescription for it. And then they would just like, you know, pocket that money, and they're a doctor, so they can write prescriptions. It's like totally unethical, but people are doing it, and it's, and you know, they're making a lot of money for it. And I guess people are paying a lot of money for it as well. I don't think that could get billed through their insurance, but you probably never know.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question either, but I think that at the end of the day, we cannot afford to trust a system where the drugs are so powerful, so, so powerful, and say, okay, well, we're going to let people just, you know, get as much of it as they like. Because how do you know? You know, the woman that they sponsored on this show, it's a two-part series, but the woman they sponsored on this show, she seemed like a very responsible, dedicated wife. And all of a sudden, you know, she's dead because she had this immense pain and she had so much medicine that it's there. And when you think about it from a different perspective, you know, so everything about our society is driven by money, right? So we're a capitalist society. Everybody wants to make as much money as they possibly can. Well, these opioid manufacturers were from the inset of the opioid drug into the mainstream pharmaceutical space. They made one company made $9 billion. That's not a T. I'm sorry. That's not an M. It's not a T, a thousand, but $9 billion. Now, if you figure how much an opioid pill costs, and there's a lot of research on how much they cost, but for the most part, they range from $6 to $106, right? So they range wherever you are, right? So if you sell enough of them to get $9 billion, you're selling a lot of drugs. You're selling a lot. And, you know, then they're kicking back to the doctor, right? So, you know, if you look at your TV any day, you will see 100 commercials for medicines that somebody wants you to tell your doctor to give you, right? Everything mm-hmm. from the shingles, you know, you name it, they got a medicine up there. And then you listen to the fine print and could cause death. So sitting there, okay, so I'm going to walk in my doctor and say, please give me this. The side effects may cause death, may. Okay, I may get hit by lightning if I go outside. I may be hit by a truck if I drive on the road. But the percentages are pretty small that that's going to happen. But I am aware that it's going to happen. Well, yeah. These things here go through the list of side effects. And you sit back like this right here. Why would I ask somebody? But somehow another of these companies, these drug manufacturing companies, want you to go tell your doctor. And then your doctor then gets some kind of kickback for writing you this prescription. Mm-hmm. No, you know, it's something about that. And so I think that in my opinion, and I think this almost every single day, the people who make commercials, marketing, all that must think the people that listen to TV are dumb as dirt. They got no brain in your head. You just an invalid because, you know, you sit there and listen to the thing, you know, you need to go pay $40 for a bra because the bra doesn't have any wires in it. And then you need to subscribe to this and you sit back and listen. Why would I do that? You know, and so every commercial is targeted at you spending money on something you may or may not need, overpriced as it could possibly be. And you're just trying to survive in a society, right? So you got your house, you got your car, you got your children, you got your family, you got all these things. And somebody wants you to go spend more money than you have on stuff that you don't need. And that's the hamburger commercial. A hamburger commercial. So you look at this. So somebody's got a fried chicken commercial there. The chicken looks so good. It's beautiful and crispy. It looks like a beautiful bun. It's, you know, all these things. You get there and it looked like they just dropped it on the floor and drug it across the floor and they put the bun on. Here you go, your hamburger. Like, okay, what happened to the hamburger? When can I get that hamburger? You don't make that hamburger. That's just a commercial. Yeah. You know,
The one in the commercial isn't actually edible. That was like handcrafted out of non-edible stuff to just make look delicious.
Oh, okay. That's what it is. But again, I go back and say, they must really think we're stupid because like when you go to the store to get that, that's not there. And this is true with almost anything. If you go, like there are a bunch of men underwear commercials on TV. I swear to God, there's so many of them. I can't keep up because I was going to buy my husband a pair, but I'm like, okay, I'm done with that too. You know, so you get this commercial and they show these nice lean men with the underwear. They fit really nice. They look really good. You know, it shows all of their body parts in a lot of ways and all that stuff. It looks so good. And then what? How much did you say it cost? $59? For what? What are you going to do with it? Is it going to bring him breakfast in the morning? Is it going to drive the car? You know, what am I getting for these $59 underwear?
Will it last a full lifetime? Like, exactly. Do they not need to be washed? What's the deal?
Exactly. And so when you see these things, you sit back and you scratch your head. It's like, oh my God, they really do think we're stupid. Mm-hmm. So I think that the way the drugs have expanded is in that same way. So if you take something like crack, or methamphetamine. I don't know if methamphetamine is a drug you can go get in the store, a pill or prescription you can get in the store, but you think about this. Somebody on the street, not a drug manufacturer, came up with this idea that you need this, right? And I'm going to be your purveyor of it. I'm going to get it to you. Yeah. So you've got these people on the street that are hustling people, which is where we get the term hustler, right? So they're hustling people to buy something they may or may not need. And that's exactly what our advertising companies are. They're hustling. And so the drug manufacturers, everybody's hustling you for some reason at all. When you look at the elections, they're hustling you because when you vote for whoever you vote for, when will you, Drew Stinnett, ever see your North Carolina politician? They're going to call you up and say, okay, after you vote for them, Drew, how are things going? Do you need anything? Is there anything we can help you with? You know, I appreciate you voting for me, but you know, whatever it is, but they disappear.
Yeah, they don't care. Because
all they want is you to vote, right?
Yeah. I think they care enough to, will it help them get reelected? And as are they going to get, maybe even, are they going to get called out on it later? And that's probably a big if, because many probably don't even care if they do get called out on it.
Right. And you're constantly being hustled. That's what you're constantly being hustled, you know, in everything about life. And I just think these drug manufacturers figured out a really good way to hustle. They hustle the doctors, they hustle the patients, you know, so you see the commercial, you need some opioids, call your doctor up and tell you just prescribed you a prescription for some opioids. Really?
Yeah.
Really? You want me to go that? You do? That's what you want me to do? Okay, no, I'm not doing that. But yeah. But I think that they must really think that we are not smart people. Nothing. You know? And they craft stories that make us think something about life. So how you thought crack was a black people drug. They craft these stories to make us believe things. And the question is I think, you know, I heard this a lot last year during 2020, is to stay woke. And it took me a while to figure out what that meant, because I didn't know what that meant. Because I'm going to tell you something, I just learned last year what shade meant. So, you know, I'm still trying to figure out all these languages. I tell you, my son speaks to me in a whole nother language. He told me, say less. Like, what? What does that mean? Oh, it means I heard you. I got it. You don't have to say anymore. Just say less.
So I had not heard that one before, exactly. So I will have to start using that in conversation.
Don't do that. I don't think that's a good thing to say, because the first time he said that to me, my feelings was hurt. What do you mean say less? You know, try to say I'm talking too much? I don't, you know, but, you know, that's a young people phrase. But I think that these terms that we use become so addictive to us that we believe them to be true. We implement them in our regular vernacular. Like I was telling you about shade, right? So when you say, like, you know, Drew, you really could have done better. I was throwing shade at you. Mm-hmm. What? You know, couldn't that have been a productive criticism, or couldn't I have been suggest? You know, but I'm throwing shade at you. So like, okay. So these terms and the way we format ourselves and what we believe become so ingrained into who we are as a society. Like, I would have bet you 10 years ago, you would have never used the term LOL. Now, I'm going to tell you something. It took me a long time to figure out what that meant. But you know, it becomes a part of who we are. And so everything in society is like that. We mold into it and accept it as fact.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.